This is XTP Media.
This love of aviation and a lucky opportunity with broadcasting have now merged into something which is what I do today and I absolutely love.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, and welcome to episode 84 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. I'm Peter Johnson, and today we've got a full team. First, we have back Tim Robinson, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Great to be back.
Very good to have you back. And even better still, we've got Gareth Stringer, who's the Executive Editor at Global Aviation Resource. Gareth, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you? It's very, very good to be here. It's been far too long.
It has been. We haven't been together for a while. Now, also joining us today as co-host and to talk about his latest TV program is Arthur Williams. Arthur is a broadcaster. He's received many rave reviews for the work that he's done. He's covered the Olympic Games, the summer, the winter, the Paralympic Games. Arthur is here today to talk to us about his work in flying documentaries and his new series due out in early August. He's an ex-Royal Marine and has served with both the Lima Company 42 Commando and 6 Assault Squadron. Then he is also a qualified pilot and an acclaimed aviation junkie. Arthur, welcome to Extended.
Hi there, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
No, it's great to have you. And we're going to come and talk about your show that's due out imminently in the UK. I think it's aired elsewhere around the world. But we're going to talk about some of the news and have a look back at some of the things that have taken place. So do join in the conversation. So let's get started and see what's caught our eye in the news. Okay, looking back then, Tim, I have to come to you first to talk Farnborough. Lots of news came out of Farnborough. Let's take it bit by bit. Let's start with the civil news first. Boeing Airbus is where it normally starts. Although the numbers of orders were up there for new aircraft, what was interesting when you actually look behind some of those numbers is there's an awful lot of commitments and not many firm orders. What's your view looking back?
Yeah, well, I think people, when going into the show, people had quite low expectations. You had Brexit overshadowing everything, lots of worries. People were a little bit uncertain. And the previous show back in big international show back in Singapore, Arthur was there. There was absolutely quiet on the commercial front. So expectation pretty low. At the end of the day, over 1,400 commitments, which again divides into firm or options, MOUs, of varying sort of levels of concreteness, but it's still, you know, worth 190 billion at list prices. So there's a little bit of smoke and mirrors in there of how many of these are firm, how many of these are you know. just sort of MOUs or a little bit sort of more sketchy. What's interesting, two things are really interesting from this show. First, it's the first show with the mega duopoly. We've now got a mega duopoly. So it's the first show where Airbus came out with the new, it's still weird to say it, A220, which is the C-Series.
Yeah,
the C-Series. C-Series. So they're now in the regional market game. And also, we had a little bit more information about Boeing's tie-up, again, on the civil front with Brazil's Embraer. So that's pitting these two behemoths into the smaller end of the market, where previously they'd sort of discounted. What it's going to do to supply chain going forward, I don't know. That some of the sort of supply chain companies are going to be putting in even more pressure. The other thing that was interesting on the civil side of things was a lot of customers were stealth customers, in that they were announced as undisclosed customer, undisclosed airline, those sort of things, which unnamed airline, which suggested quite a few airlines there who were keeping their heads down and trying to keep. Not get involved in any kind of US-China or US-EU trade war.
Right.
So that, you know, there's still this strong demand. There's still a mega demand for civil airliners. You know, problem there is building their things fast enough. But some of the airlines now are taking a little bit, trying to do it. Boost their fleet and get the capacity on the quiet without sort of putting their head above the parapet and getting potentially to political difficulties.
And Tim, you talked about suppliers there, and there's not everything from nuts and bolts to seats and windows, but I suppose the biggest talk of the town over the last year has been engines, and I don't think many of the manufacturers have got off too lightly with this massive growth that we're seeing. Can the engine manufacturers really keep up? I mean, the problems are well publicised already. You know, we're seeing airliners with empty bowls on their wings at the moment, all across the world.
Yeah, I mean, the engine guys at the moment are not having a great time of it. Rolls has had its troubles. Obviously, Pratt & Whitney supplying the GTF geared fan to Airbus. Airbus now have got a real challenge on their hands to try and what they call is front load or back load. Basically, to try and catch up and get the and get these aircraft delivered with engines, because obviously, people tend to like airliners with engines, if at all possible.
It helps to know.
Hey, guys, I was actually only speaking, I'll just chip in. I was only speaking to a couple of pilots that fly for a well-known UK airline that I won't mention, and they're actually in the position of almost on the brink of falling out of currency on type, because the number of the aircraft in that fleet are grounded because they don't have engines for them.
It's a real issue, and it's stretching, as you say, into all sorts of issues. Now, I mean, the leasing companies have got a limited capacity, but I think they're all maxing out, doing good business. But there's also a reputational issue as well. The 787 came out in glory. Everyone loved it. Now it's slightly tarnished because of the Rolls issue. And everyone talks about the gliders at Toulouse. It's quite interesting.
And the other thing is, they're trying to fix the existing problems they've got, while at the same time ramp up production and get even more airlines out the door. I mean, this is the problem with Brexit. Just before Farnborough, there was a briefing from Airbus, pre-show briefing, and they were talking about what mitigation measures could you put in? Could you stockpile spares? And they were sort of saying, we've got the supply chain basically running flat out as it is. Asking them to sort of, can you build 3 months more of inventory, or 3 months more of wings, or 3 months more of engines, and have that on top of what we're already asking them to do. This is why they're so worried.
Mm. Okay, let's move on then, because that could run and run. Let's talk some military news. Big news of the show, it was Britain. We stole the show with the Tempest.
So, yeah, that was the big news on Monday. Combat air strategy and reveal of the Tempest 6th generation fighter. Or just to sort of put it in context. So we had the defense minister turn up on the Monday, big song and dance sort of ceremony, and big reveal, and this stunning looking stealth fighter revealed from behind a curtain. It was pretty impressive. Lots of top brass there from the RAF and from other nations as well. Very tellingly. But it's not a production fighter that is going to be flying in the air in the next 10 years. It's really an R&D program. And there's technology involved with it. There's things like augmented reality cockpit, which I tried, which are very, very cool, where you have all the instruments. The instrument screen in the actual aircraft is just completely blank. There's not even backup instruments, and it's all projected into your helmet. And you can put your displays here, there, everywhere. It really is a sort of stunning technology. So part of its technology.
Tim, does that mean there's room for the pilots to pin their favorite crossword to the panel then?
There certainly is. You could have your Skype thing running there. You could be watching Love Island in the corner probably. as long as HQ weren't monitoring you.
Even saw they're hoping as well for it to potentially have the ability to fly as well without a pilot. Am I right in seeing that?
Yeah, the whole thing about Tempest is they want it to be as flexible as possible, and flexible as fighter, adaptable, and also so part of it's the technology. So you've got augmented reality cockpit, hypersonic missiles, directed energy weapons. Let's put lasers on it. Pew pew pew. Part of it is also is make it flexible, make it lower, well, not lower cost, affordable, adaptable. And how I like to think, how I sort of tried to work it out in my mind was if you're comparing it to the F-35 is a bit like, I suppose you'd say it's a bit like the iPhone. You've got a locked system, so everybody has to lock into go into the same system, and you've got all the all the logistics stuff, which is great. Everybody's on the one system, and you get updates, and that's fantastic. Tempest, I think, seems to be leaning a lot more to the Android type of operating system, Android smartphone, where you've got a base operating system there, but you're free to add whatever apps you want. And that is something that is really catching other countries' eyes and other partners' eyes around the world. That, oh, hang on, Britain's here with a 6th-gen fighter that we could, and that's what it was. It's a showcase for UK technology, saying this is what we think the successor to Typhoon may be for 2035, 2040. It's a technology program. Why didn't you come and join us?
And wasn't that really the overriding message here, Tim? I think we all get this was quite a bold move from a strategy perspective, and I thought as well quite a bold move from a industry perspective, a bit of a kick up the bum, if you like, to say, well, hang on, we are Britain and we've still got a military sector, but were we trying to catch a little march on everybody else in terms of getting partners on board as well?
Well, as far as I know, it's the first 6th-generation. If you count the fighters by generations, and there's some people who disagree with that, but it's the first 6th-generation fighter program that has been opened up to international partnerships. So that's even before the US has decided what a 6th-generation fighter is, before anybody else.
China will probably roll theirs out next week.
And Tim, am I right in saying that Lockheed Martin have already shown signs of wanting to participate in this?
Boeing, interesting enough. Boeing, Saab, right. Saab reported to be interested. The Franco-German, also there's a similar effort going on between the French and the Germans, and there's other countries around the world. I mean, you know, the reveal was you look around and there was kind of top brass from, you know, sort of Japan to here, there, and everywhere, sort of all sort of stood there watching this thing, you know, watching the big unveiling. But I think it's a showcase, and it's also before that. I think people had sort of not written the UK off, but they'd sort of said, "Oh well, you know, Typhoon after that, what happens?" You know, and it was a sort of like it was expectation that the UK was kind of going into managed decline. You know, we'd do a few mods for Typhoon, and then we'd perhaps call it a day. So this is, you know, like you said, Gareth, it's a really bold move. It's a positive move. There were the journalists there who you usually sort of quite cynical about, you know, anything to do with UK MOD, and they were coming out saying, "Oh, we could do this." But a big split, weirdly, between British aviation defense journos and US journos, you know, US based journos over there, whose basic response was, "Huh? does not compute with the Brits with a fighter?"
Yeah. and lots of people quoting Firefox.
Yes.
Now, what does the Tempest remind everyone of? Wasn't there the aircraft that came that was competing for what turned out to be the F-22? Wasn't the other prototype looked similar in shape? Was it the 21?
The YF-23, wasn't that?
Yeah.
I did think it looked a little bit like Firefox, and also a little bit like the F-19, which people may remember, which was the rumoured stealth fighter, which even had a model kit come out, but obviously turned out to be the F-117 and was nothing like, didn't look anything like the F-117 at all. But my first instinct, I have to say, was Firefox, and all the quotes people were saying about, you know, you have to think in Russian and all those sorts of lines. Yeah. I have to say, I thought, and I'm pretty sure whatever this aircraft turns out to be, it'll probably look completely different to what we saw at Farnborough. But I have to say, I thought it looked fantastic, and there was a real sense of I was quite excited when it appeared. You know, Tim, you were tweeting it, and I didn't even know. I don't know if did anybody know this was coming? Were we expecting to see a mock-up? I thought it was quite exciting.
Not until very close to the time. No, that this was something. And weirdly, it wasn't supposed to be called Tempest at all. It's Team Tempest for the consortium. So that's MOD, BA Systems, MBDA, who did the missiles, Leonardo, who did the sensors, and obviously Rolls-Royce, who did the engines. And they hadn't got a name for it. And, I've been told that they were saying, "Well, you know, what are we going to call it?" Well, it's a future combat systems mock. I can't call it that. Anyway, Defence Secretary Gavin Williamson, he solved the problem because he came up there and referred to it and said, "This is the Tempest brilliant. Fighter jet, and it'll be flying with a Typhoon, the F-35 in 2035. And I think, great, because you've got a name now. You know, you've got a name, even though it's not a thing as such, because everything else is called, you know, blooming FCAS. Yeah. No one remembers FCAS. People remember Tempest.
It's a bit like the SR-71, isn't it? Which should have been called the RS-71, but was announced in a public announcement by whoever was it McNamara, whoever the US Defense Secretary was at the time. He inadvertently called it the SR-71. And rather than correct him politically, they just changed all of the drawings and the name and changed the name of the aircraft.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, listen, let's crack on to some other good news for the UK aerospace sector. And there were announcements after announcements about UK spaceports as well, Tim. The vertical launch facility in Scotland and Virgin creeping into Cornwall to support Newquay and their spaceport down there. How exciting is all that news?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, we had expectations of a quiet show, and then all of a sudden you were you know, commercial orders, new sixth-gen fighter concept, and lots of space news going on at the same time. It really was sort of bonkers. So very exciting news for UK space industry. Going to have a spaceport on the north coast of Scotland. There's some money also going for horizontal launch for Cornwall with Virgin Orbit. And we're going to be building rockets, you know, good building rockets in the UK. Lockheed Martin, obviously big company, yeah. Lockheed Martin, they're going to be building upper stages. You know, in Bedford, I think. And so, who would have thought that you know, 5 years ago, that Lockheed Martin would be building rocket upper stages?
Yeah,
in Bedfordshire, you know, people would have you know, had you committed to the asylum for thinking that.
Yeah, to be fair, the UK Space Agency has done a sterling job since its conception a few years ago, and I heard a comment yesterday. That around half of all the commercial satellites launched are made in the UK. So, you know, it makes a lot of sense to put the bit underneath it and do it ourselves.
And small sats, which is what we're good at, is where the you know, the big money is these days. And also, interestingly, for military stuff as well, is if you've got lots of small satellites, like the RAF's Carbonite 2 satellite. Full motion video from space, fraction of the cost of a big US spy satellite. It's all commercial tech, and it's all that small satellite. You know, and if you've got lots of them, you build resilience in, and nobody can take down your satellites all in one go.
Mm, yeah, wonderful, wonderful news. So, Tim, looking back, and Arthur, were you at Farnborough, by the way?
Yeah. So I was at Farnborough. I was working with Embraer, who I've been doing a couple of jobs with. As Tim mentioned earlier, I was at Singapore. I was also at Paris Air Show in June last year as well. I was only there for a day, but it's such an incredible show, Farnborough, you know. I mean, you go to these air shows around the world and things, and Farnborough really is still a showstopper. I mean, the amount of people that attend, the amount of big business that goes on there is just incredible. It blows my mind anyway.
Yeah Okay. Well, let's move on to talk about air shows, but I just want to make one comment before we leave Farnborough. There's been a fair bit of criticism from the public, from the public 2 days, the Saturday and the Sunday, about the quality of the actual air display. The feeling was that you know, most of the displays were done during the week, and even those were pretty average. Tim, what's your view on this? Because historically, I always saw it as a punter going along to look at aeroplanes, but it's really a trade show, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the highlight of the week, bizarrely enough, civil air freight aircraft, propeller driven, was the sort of aerobatic highlight of the display.
Is this the Herc doing the loop, Gordon Bennett?
Yeah, it's impressive, isn't it?
For the public, I think they need to address that somehow if they are going to promote it at the weekend and they're going to try and keep people here. I mean, you understand, obviously, the big commercial guys, they've got to get these aircraft back. Some of them are, you know, sort of taking time out from expensive flight test campaigns. They're on the way to customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think something has to be done to balance it out a bit. If you're determined to say, look, you know, we're keeping this as a public event as well, and we want the public to get excited about aviation, we want kids to get excited about aviation, then, you know, there's got to be an incentive, I think, to keep companies around the weekend somehow and to boost the boost the air display of the weekend. And you know, down the road, the weekend before, not down the road, but you had React, you had Flying Legends, amazing you know, venues for flying displays, so, you know, not short of aircraft.
Arthur, you were at Flying Legends. Tell us what you saw. Was it a good show? I didn't get to any of these, unfortunately.
Yeah, Flying Legends was amazing. I mean, I went I went from Farnborough to, or either from Flying Legends to Farnborough, I can't remember which because it was all just a blur, but I went there with my family. And of course, for anybody that knows about Flying Legends or has seen it, just knows that it's an absolute aviation geek festival. It's fantastic. It's really, really good. There was loads and loads of stuff on. The Red Bull DC-6 was probably my personal highlight of the show. You got this four engine propeller driven chrome beast that was thrown around like a fighter. If you've ever seen, I don't know, what is it, 1950s airliner, 1940s airliner, and the pilot was doing wing overs. He was going near vertical with it. It was just amazing. But then, of course, you had the American Eagle display. And we saw the F-35 make a special appearance in a flypast with a Spitfire and a Mustang on each wing. And my Lord, everybody was choking up. And the entire, I don't know how many people were there. There must have been 80,000 plus probably there. And it just caught everybody off guard and they loved it. It was an amazing, amazing show. But just one point about Farnborough and what Tim was saying about the public weekend. Muted, perhaps. I find it ever so slightly sad in the fact that Farnborough has turned into, and there's certainly the impression that you get if you go during the week and the trade days and the corporate days, it certainly seems very sad that, you know, you've got the big weapons companies almost turning it into an arms fair and paying lip service to the public display days that are there for the enjoyment of everybody, when you think that back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, Farnborough was a show where Britain as a country could show off its prowess in the aviation industry. You know, we would go along and we would show you this jet, we would show you that jet, and this is what we can do, this is what we've got coming up. And now it just seems such a shame that we're paying lip service to that and we're not really in a position to be able to show off what we have got.
Yeah, hear, hear. Good, well said. Just one quick question. You mentioned there the Red Bull DC-6. Listener Paul Cannon, in fact, messaged me just before the start of the show. Now, he lives up near Welwyn Garden City, and he's said, I've got a question for you because you're bound to know the answer, which obviously I don't. He said, the other day, an old four-engine prop liner in what he thought was BOAC colours came over his house. What is it? obviously, he must have seen the Red Bull DC-6, I'm assuming, or something like that.
Yeah, it would have been. I'm not sure if its official title is the Red Bull. Anyway, Tim and Gareth would probably be able to correct me, but it was the chrome one, you know, with the blue streak down the side, and I think it was, you know, in Red Bull colours or whatever. But my Lord, was she impressive when she did a taxi down the line, and you've got all those beautiful props running and the piston engines going, and she just looks fantastic, absolutely fantastic. She captures all of the glamour of vintage aviation that we all absolutely adore. And then she taxied back to the line with a little bit of disappointment to myself and family. And a little later on in the afternoon, she then took off and she did this display. And I'd imagine that your man there who was getting in touch was probably quite alarmed with what this apparent airliner was doing.
He said it was very, very low.
Well, he was low. And I know that there are new restrictions placed on Doxford displays over Doxford Village itself, which means that the pilots have to be particularly on the ball with how they perform and the way in which they approach the field. But by God, this aircraft was almost doing wing overs. And if you've ever seen a 1950s four engine piston airliner doing a wing over, then gosh, you got something on me, because I saw it for the first time the other weekend and it was incredible.
Well, Flying Legends, obviously impressive this year. Gareth, Riyat was, from everything I saw, I mean, I was, as we all know, laid up and glued to social media. Just an amazing show by the sounds of things, and great celebration of the RAF 100 anniversary.
Yeah, and I guess, ironically, I think the thing that, you know, that and also obviously Air Day at Yeovilton, one thing that everyone's tended to benefit from is this incredible weather that we've been having in the UK. And I guess the irony of that is the one part really of React that got affected was the Friday display with some of the smaller scale RAF 100 flypasts that were planned, following on obviously from the, you know, the major flypast over London down the Mall and Buckingham Palace, which was absolutely incredible. But yeah, generally speaking, I mean, you know, an incredible lineup. Big shout out to Tom Gibbons and his team at Fairford for putting such an incredible lineup together. Sparkling weather. I think, you know, if you spoke to anyone that went, you'd probably argue with them all night about what the highlights were. But, you know, we had things like Flanker. We had the F-35A that Arthur's already mentioned. We also had an appearance from F-35B, including with Lancaster and Tornado GR4 as a 617, a Dam Buster 617 Squadron tribute. And should be noted as well, that is Tornado GR4's final appearance at an International Air Tattoo, which seems bizarre, really. They will be finishing, I think, in March of next year. We had this incredible schemed Canadian Hornet display, which also did Yeovilton. I mean, so much to mention, and we are so lucky. And as Tim said, it seems extraordinary, really, that the week after you've got Farnborough, and yes, we know it's all about, I'm sorry to just go back to this, but I'll get my soapbox out quickly. it is about business, but I agree completely with Arthur. You know, you look back over history, and Farnborough was behaving with the public, seeing these new aircraft and the British industry at its best. And it strikes me now, and I agree with Tim, they need to reassess that weekend show. There's this mass exodus of aircraft prior to the public show, which you still pay pretty good money to go into, incidentally. And I think they need, and also there are restrictions at Farnborough. The Red Arrows can't display there anymore. I think they've got a big opportunity, though, to make this into a huge STEM and educational weekend, maybe with a trimmed down air show that, you know, there's expectations have to be managed, but use that resource on the ground to make that into a credible, an incredible weekend for youngsters and families to learn about industry and technology. Don't put all your eggs in that basket of the flying display, and then having to, things were flying twice this weekend because it was so thin on the ground. And that to me is wrong at any air show. But it's especially painful to see that happening somewhere like Farnborough.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Why not move it back to September?
Yeah, another
deconflict it with everything else, and then you've got a bit of a breather, haven't you? Which it used to be.
I don't think that would have a particular impact on, you know, industry or business wise, Tim, would it? I can't see that being a particular problem.
No, I don't really know.
So something to think about. But yeah, you know, we've talked about air shows a lot on here, Peter, haven't we, over the years. And for anyone wanting us to talk a little bit more about RAF 100, just hold your horses for probably the next episode after this, because we're going to be talking to somebody who was quite literally in the thick of all of that. But RAF Air Day, fantastic. Flying Legends, fantastic. And you know, well done. I feel as if we've come over the hump a little bit from the, obviously, the tragedy of Shoreham, and that everything is beginning to blossom again. I felt, you know, there was definitely a hangover from that awful day, and I feel as if we've moved on from that a little bit now.
Saw some classic stuff at Air Day. Saw the Sycamore and stuff like that, which was
Sycamore is incredible, absolutely incredible.
I didn't think I'd see one of those fly again. I honestly didn't. So we're very lucky. So we'll leave it on that positive note. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back to talk to Arthur.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Okay, so Arthur, we're going to talk to you about your new program, but just to put things into context, tell us a little bit about your career. I mentioned the Royal Marines there. Tell us about how your career has progressed and you end up in the front seat of a Piper Cub.
Yeah, sure. So really, I think it's all for myself been a bit mental, to be quite honest. It's been a story of opportunities, good successes, major lows, highs, and all sorts. Like you said there, I started out with the Royal Marines. But really, joining the Royal Marines wasn't a boyhood dream. Actually, being a pilot was a boyhood dream. When I was at school, I wasn't a particularly large child. And when I went through my sort of teenage adolescent years on the backseat of the bus, I was with a group of friends. And my father was in the Navy. He did 17 years as an engineer, engineering officer. And I said, because of course, looking at all of his influences and things, I said, well, I'd love to, you know, what about the Marines? They seem like a pretty cool job. And they must have said, they said, you can do that, you know. And of course, that for me was like red rag to a bull. So that's what I had to go and do. And I went on to join the Royal Marines and did quite successfully at it. And I loved it as a job. It was absolutely fantastic. But before that, I grew up reading about Douglas Bader, watching Reach for the Skies, Battle of Britain, Memphis Belle, Aces High, you know, those magnificent men and their flying machines. That's what I loved. And then my life took the change with the Marines. And then in 2007, that all came to sort of a very abrupt end when I was traveling back to camp with my partner at the time. And we had a very nasty road accident. And I wasn't wearing my seatbelt at the time. And of course, there's a message there for anybody who thinks that they shouldn't wear a seatbelt is that you must. And I broke my back. I broke my back in two places and I severed my spinal cord, which left me with paralysis, which means I can't operate or feel parts of my body just above my belly button. And as you can imagine, the rehabilitation and road to recovery was long and hard. About 12 months after the initial accident, I was in a position where I was sort of getting my independence back again, and I was getting my health and fitness back. But for me, the biggest part of rehabilitation, when they tell many people with disabilities that the best way forward is to get involved with sport, I didn't want to be put into a box with other people that I didn't want to do the same as everybody else. I wanted to do something that was true to myself, and I didn't want to be defined by my disability. And so therefore, my dad, upon leaving the Navy, was a resettlement officer. And funnily enough, I found himself on one of his courses. He was a resettlement officer for people who were coming out of the military and joining Civvy Street. And I found myself on one of his courses. And one of the great tips that he gave was to grab a yellow pages and flick from front to back, looking at all the vocations and see if there's anything there that you like or stick. And I did that, and there wasn't anything. And then I kind of had a eureka moment. And I remembered back to the legendary Douglas Bader, And of course, everybody that listens to this will know who Douglas Bader was. He was a Battle of Britain fighter ace who lost both of his legs during the war, but went on to then fly. Well, he didn't lose his legs during the war, did he? I'm sorry. He lost his legs in an accident with Gloucester Gladiator, but he went on to regain his pilot's license in the RAF in the 1940s, flying Hurricanes and Spitfires. And I thought, by God, if he can do it back then, I'm sure that I'll be able to do it in the 21st century. So I started, you know, internet searches, and I came across an organization called the British Disabled Flying Association, who are now known as Airability. And I sent a message and I said, look, I'm paralyzed. Would it be possible for me to fly? And they said, yeah, absolutely. Come on down for a trial lesson. And that was a trial lesson towards a private pilot's license. And of course, when I got down there, I established lines of communication and discovered that for me, as a person who really can't control two-thirds of his body, a path within aviation, and indeed a career in aviation, is a possibility. And this for me was an absolute revelation. You know, this was the best piece of news that I'd heard for a very long time. And so I grabbed it with both hands, and I haven't looked back since. And I went on to get my PPL. Well, I got my MPPL first, then I transferred over to the JAR PPL, and now I've got EASA, of course. And I've since got my IMC rating, I've got my night rating, I've got my tailwheel endorsement. And there really is no restriction. And CAA, for all of the grief that we give them about giving aviation a hard time, through my experiences, have been fantastic. They've always been of the opinion, both in engineering departments and medical, that, look, Arthur, prove to us that you can do it safely, and we have no reason to tell you that you can't. And that's just been fantastic for me. And so that's how I got involved with flying, with the view at the time to go on and do it commercially. And it was at this time that, of course, I needed work. Another huge part of my rehabilitation and getting life back on track was to find work. If I could find work in a career, then I would be able to be financially independent and, you know, God willing, at some point in the future, support a family. And for me, and as a bloke with a Neolithic way of thinking, that is what we need to do. That's what I need to do. So that's what I needed to do. And a friend, and you'll laugh at this, I'm sure, a friend noticed in about 2011 that there was an article in a newspaper, and it stated that Channel 4 were looking for 50% of their on-screen personalities to present the London 2012 Paralympics to have disabilities. And he cut the article out, he put it in an envelope, and he put a footnote in it saying, Arthur, put in for this because you need a job, you're not bad looking, and you're a gobshite. So I obviously sent him a text message back, which I won't repeat over the air, but I did. I approached the channel, and long story short, I went for several interviews. I sent them a video of myself presenting something about wheelchair racing, which I was doing for fitness at the time, and they put me on a contract to present the London 2012 Paralympic Games, which we did and won a BAFTA for. And then after the games, it was at a Christmas party, in the fallout from all of the great reviews that we'd had for our coverage of the games, where I was introduced to an editor of the specialist factual documentary department of Channel 4. And we were both drunk at the bar. And he said, Arthur, I know you're a pilot. And I know you've got a military background. So we've got to do some documentary stuff. And we were trying to thrash out ideas. And he's just said, right, what's your favorite aeroplane? And of course, I said the de Havilland Mosquito. And he was thinking I was going to say Spitfire or Concorde or whatever. And he had no idea what the Mosquito was. And at the bar, stood right there, I sung its praises to such a degree that he commissioned a 1-hour documentary film right there, which then wow, turned into the plane that saved Britain. And then once we'd done that, God, well, the floodgates were open for me to continue at the channel with Paralympic sport and broadcasting live sport. But then we also opened up into a world of aviation. And I found that this love of aviation and a lucky opportunity with broadcasting have now merged into something which is what I do today and I absolutely love.
Now, wow. I came across you, Arthur, when you did the Flying to the Ends of the Earth series. I think you've done two series of that, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. So the first series went out 2014 and then second in 16.
Yeah, now we watched that as a family, and you know, normally aeroplanes in this house are limited to my exposure, but we really, really enjoyed that. And I suppose what it brought was you had a way of presenting some of the travels and the places you went to that made it wider than just aviation, but it still had that hook. And I think that's what really dragged people's attention to your style of presenting, and we loved it, and you know, really enjoyed the second series as well. But you've got a new series coming up, haven't you? And that's just about to air here. I think it's already aired in other parts of the world, though, hasn't it?
Yeah. So it's called Flying Across Britain with Arthur Williams, and actually, I can tell you that it hasn't aired anywhere else in the world.
Hasn't it? Right.
No, but I can understand why you think there's a funny story about it. Really, Australia and New Zealand bought the rights, and they went as far, you'll laugh at this, they went as far as to advertising it on their television. But then the Channel 4, who initially commissioned it, got wind of it and were like, whoa, we can't do that. So they had to pull the plug. So it hasn't actually gone out in Australia.
Right. Excellent.
I can only imagine that they were absolutely furious at the fact. But anyway, we won't digress. So no, nobody else in the world has seen it. It's coming out in the UK first this Sunday, 7 p.m. on Channel 4, and I love it. Honestly, So the Flying to the Ends of the Earth was telling the stories of aviation, but really the sort of the selling point of that was that we wanted to so aviation, and of course we don't know this because we're absolutely passionate about it, but it is actually quite a niche following when you're speaking in the terms of a huge terrestrial broadcaster in the UK. So we needed to do something that would appeal to a wider audience, and a travel log discovering places that hadn't been seen on television before was one of the reasons that the Flying to the Ends of the Earth series was commissioned. But of course it followed, aviation was the common theme that stitched it all together, and hopefully my love for all of that came through. But Flying Across Britain with myself is more heavily associated with flying, because many of the stories that we see when we are traveling around Britain are aviation related stories. And for anybody who has a passion of aviation, I promise you that you're going to learn stuff from the series, and you're also going to be wow factored, because I've learned stuff on there that I just had absolutely no idea about.
And
that's a lovely looking.
No, I was just going to say we both interrupted and probably going to say the same thing. Tell us about the aeroplane.
What were you going to say, Tim?
Tell us about that lovely 1943 Piper Cub.
Oh well, she's my blooming pride and joy. That's where I spend my pennies. Now I've got to be careful because my wife is in was probably within earshot, but Rebecca is my wife, but Echo Yankee's my mistress. anybody who knows aeroplanes will know that the Piper Cub is it's got a special place amongst people's hearts. There is, I don't think, ever been a bad word spoken about that aircraft, from the way that she looks, but really just down to the way that she performs and flies. She is so easy to fly, and she is so forgiving that there is a love for that thing that is hard to put into words. She's a magic machine, really.
And you fly her around Britain. What are the sort of places you go to? What's the theme of your visits?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a four-part series, and each of the episodes broadly are focused on a particular region of the country. So I think in episode one, we're going to the southwest, where we go to, if don't ask me to name all the airfields that we landed at.
I think you visit Compton Abbas, don't you?
Yeah. We go to Compton Abbas, one of the most beautiful little strips in Britain from a general aviation perspective. And we speak to the owner there, Clive. We go to a fly-in. Oh, but we go to Henstridge, Nimpsfield. We've gone all over the Yeovilton. We try to tell the story. What I like and what I've been saying to people when they ask me is that we go from microlights on the Isle of Sheppey to fast jet F-15 strike Eagles out of Lake and Heath. You know, it really is that broad a range. But so we've got the Southwest as the first episode. I don't know what the episode order is yet. We've got a London episode in which we go to Biggin Hill. We fly the Spitfire, which is amazing. Do you know, I say and joke with my friends that after I did the Mosquito film and I go around all the clubs and people go, you're the git that got to fly the Mosquito. It's a miracle my nose isn't out of joint. But after I've flown the Spitfire as well, I think it's a miracle. So we did that. And then we went up to the eastern counties, Lincolnshire, Norfolk and Suffolk. And with that episode, we try not to, in any of the episodes, focus too heavily on the RAF, because I think within aviation, we all have a kind of natural feeling of returning to the RAF as the sort of conduit that flows throughout the center of general aviation, because of course many pilots that fly with the RAF fly general aviation. Many of the British Airways pilots that fly general aviation were at one point RAF. So we try not to focus too heavily on the Royal Air Force. But one episode in the eastern counties, and again, I don't know which number it is, we do talk about the RAF, and we go to Cranfield, and amazingly, we find out the history of my grandfather. Both my grandfathers were in the RAF. One of them was a ground engineer, the other was an air engineer, and my grandfather on my father's side, who was a ground engineer, was mentioned in dispatches during the war. And the family rumor goes that it was because he pulled a pilot out of a burning Spitfire. And of course, me and my brothers now think, oh no, that can't be true. It's just too good. We're only the Williamses. That could never have happened. And anyway, you will see in the episode what happens, but it's fascinating. And we also we talk about the sort of friendly invasion of the Americans coming over and operating the 8th Air Force out of those eastern regions. We go for a little jolly in Just Jane, the Lancaster that's on taxi runs. And that's that. I do like that episode. Not that I don't like any of them, but I like all of them. But that one was really good fun. And then we go up to Scotland. The little cub managed to get all the way up there. It's a miracle. Took 7 stops. We went Bidford, Slape in Shropshire, Blackpool, Carlisle, Carlisle, Prestwick, Oban, and then to Glenforser in the Isle of Mull and Brendan in his. And there was a time last year where we had this incredible period of low pressure that sat over the country, and which meant we had blue skies throughout all of the UK. And that was the window that I needed to get this very fragile little aeroplane all the way up to the Western Isles. And it was a hell of an adventure. I think we did just over 100 hours flying time to be able to pull off all the filming. I think I added 20 airfields to my logbook that I hadn't been to before, and met a whole host of people who were just absolutely fascinating and bonkers about aviation, but from all different walks of life. And it was just brilliant fun.
I think this sounds fantastic. And, hats off to Channel 4 for commissioning this and getting you in the air. But I mean, I think it's critically important, actually, because it sounds like it's not going to not only appeal to you know, people like us and the usual suspects who will go to Farmer, go to React, go to Flying Legends, but also the general public and who've kind of lost touch a little bit their local airfield. You know, they might see a light aircraft go flying over, or they might sort of see a Spitfire occasionally and go, oh, hang on, I wonder where that's kind of flying from, but not get the full picture. I mean, there is a big debate going on, that there's questions being raised in Parliament, actually, you know, the all parliamentary group on general aviation, of how to revive and how to sort of stimulate local grassroots aviation. And anything that gives people like an insight into, so, oh, there's a local, my local aerodrome does that, I didn't know. Sounds great.
Yeah, well, that was one, because as I mentioned earlier about the series of flying around the world, flying to the ends of the earth, you have to be able to, from a brutally business perspective, because of course the channels need the viewing figures, they have to have their programs as a success, and flying can be a niche. So how is this going to be able to appeal to a wider audience? And we worked out that about 90% of the population of the UK will, in their everyday life, drive past, see an aeroplane in the sky, live near to, or work on an airfield or an aviation related site or a disused field, whether you're driving past it on your commute to work or you live within a stone's throw of it. And so that sort of plucked up the ears of the channel and made them think, oh, actually, this is something that would have a massive reach, because the people that are going to be watching the program might have an interest in it because we'll be talking about somewhere that's just down the road from them, or they have an interest in it, or in some way forms a part of their everyday life. And that's what we want, you know. As we've mentioned earlier in the show, it's just so, and as Tim's just mentioned, it's so important to keep grassroots people coming from, because if we keep, and I need to be careful not to get onto a political rant here, but if we find ourselves infringing on these sites that support our general aviation community, then where are you going to get your airline pilots from in 10 years time? You know, there may be, and I can't say that it's the truth, but there may be a misconception that flying is simply for the privileged, and it's just absolutely not the case. We make the point in the series, and it's fundamentally important for boys and girls, just as we were when we were growing up, to have an interest in aviation, to be able to support the aerospace industry, which all of us enjoy and use when we go on holiday, way into the future. And I think we're in danger of jeopardizing that at the moment.
Fascinating stuff there, Arthur. Really looking forward to seeing the series. Where can we find out more about you online and on social media?
Yeah, sure. So I've got a website, arthurwilliams.co.uk. I'm on Twitter with ArthurVW1986 and on Instagram as ArthurVWilliams. If you go onto the Channel 4 website and look on the programs schedule, you'll also be able to find out information on the series there.
Wonderful. Thanks very much, Arthur. Right, we'll take a quick break and then we'll come back and do some promoting aerospace.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
We know you're in there.
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time. And that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, promoting aerospace. Gareth, I'll come to you first.
Well, we love a good book on Extended.
We
I don't
do.
Think anyone would deny that. And I wanted to give I think Tim and I have got quite a similar thing to talk about. But mine specifically is John Nichols' new book, Spitfire, a very British love story. It's already a Sunday Times bestseller. I bought myself a copy, and I've subsequently bought my dad a copy. If he's listening now, I've just given away what his birthday present is because I'm not seeing him for a few days. But it's a fantastic, it just is a brilliant, brilliant book about, how do you describe it? It's a national treasure. It's an icon, probably one of the most iconic British machines of all time. And I would just say, if you've got any interest in aviation, which hopefully you have if you're listening to us waffling along, and you haven't got it, just go and get it. And it adds to the whole canon of Spitfire, as does, I think, something that you want to mention, Tim, and it's all very timely as well, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. So my shout out is for a film, Spitfire, the feature documentary. It's a feature length ode to this Spitfire. Cinematography by a certain John Dibbs, who, if you know your Warbirds photography, it's him let loose with a movie camera, and amazing recollections from veterans in there. There's no CGI in it, there's no daft reenactors, and there's just pure, beautiful, gorgeous shots of Spitfires flying, and recollections from these veterans. And I'm actually sort of talking with a bit of a tear in my eye, because we've had three of them who've been lost in the past fortnight, I think now. Geoffrey Wellham, obviously First Light, Wing Commander Tom Neal, yeah. And Mary Ellis at 101, who has outlived the 1 year older than the Royal Air Force itself, and all of them were in the film. I was privileged enough to be at the London premiere, where Mary Ellis was there in an ATA uniform, and she and three other veterans at the front got a standing ovation. So this film, it's still on release, I think, at the moment. You can probably still find it. There is a DVD and a Blu-ray coming out in September, I think, as well. But if you can catch on the big screen, just go and see it. And bring tissues.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thanks for that, Tim. Thanks, Gareth. Arthur, just before we move on, any mentions from you?
Yeah, sure. I've got a couple. I just have to echo what Tim said, actually, about, it seems like when it rains, it pours, doesn't it? And the fact that we lost these three incredibly awesome people in such a short space of time, I think it's taken everybody by shock. It's been terrible, really. And it really, I suppose, it just highlights the fact that we've got to try to capture as many of their stories and interviews with them on tape and video as we can before the few, because become no more. But my sort of aerospace recommendations actually is a book first that I was sent by Penguin to review a number of weeks ago, but it's come out now. You can get it on Amazon and Waterstones. It's called 6 Weeks of Blenheim Summer. It's authored by Alistair Panton. It's the story of, I think, his father or grandfather, who was a Blenheim pilot during the Battle of France, and then subsequently was a prisoner of war, and then went on to continue the war as a pilot during the conflict. And it's a fascinating first person's account of the struggles of the British Expeditionary Force and the Air Force in France in those early days of the war, and how terrible life was for them and how much of a struggle it was. Anybody that's interested in the Second War and history will really, really love reading that book, and I thoroughly recommend it. 6 Weeks of Blenheim Summer, published or authored by Alistair Panton. So that's my book fascination. It's just sprung into my mind as I was thinking there. But also, I have to give a shout out to Airability, the disabled flying charity. As I spoke of earlier about my journey to my wings, when they were the British Disabled Flying Association, they were kind of like the light at the end of the tunnel. And they offer opportunities not just for people who want to become pilots. They offer any opportunity for anybody, no matter how severe the disability, to experience the thrill of flight. And you can be severely disabled in an incredibly heavy, cumbersome electric wheelchair with life supporting machines and things. Airability will get you into an aircraft and get you the experience of freedom that flight offers, that we all enjoy so much. And if any of you listening know of anybody that has a disability who needs a break, would benefit from anything that they offer, then I cannot recommend enough getting in touch with them down at Blackbush Airport, because they change lives. They change mine, and they're phenomenal.
Thanks for that, Arthur. I've got a shout out for the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust. I mentioned them in the last episode. What I forgot to mention is that they've got a book sale on. They've been donated, I think, a couple of thousand books, and they're all up for sale on eBay. I'll put a link in the show notes to their pages. What Claire at Fast has done for us, though, is she said that extended listeners can get a 10% discount on the purchase price of any of those books. So if you want to take that offer up, you can make your best offer on the price with the discount, but add a message so that Claire knows that you heard about it on Extended. I will just say they are a charity, though, so if you can skip the 10%, please do. But having looked through the list, there's some pretty decent books on there, and I know we've got some collectors listening, so you might want to get on there and snap those up. So Farnborough Air Sciences Trust, and I'll put a link in that to the show notes. That is just about all we have time for. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can, of course, find Extended now on all the major podcast playing platforms, including Stitcher.com and, of course, Apple Podcasts. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask, though, before you use anything that you have been listening to. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Arthur, a massive thank you for coming on to the program. Really enjoyed it. Can't wait to see Flying Across Britain. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to all you guys. Tim, Gareth, Peter, thank you very much for having me on, and I hope that I can come and join you again soon, actually, just have a general chin wag about aviation geekery.
Of course.
Thanks, yeah. Arthur.
Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I'm twittering on Twitter at RES Tim R, and you find the Royal Aeronautical Society at www.aerosociety.com.
Gareth, how about you? Where can we find you online?
Yeah, globalaviationresource.com for everything related to the website, and you can find me at Gareth @Peter_Stringer on Twitter. And I just wanted to say, Peter, you had a pretty bad accident a few weeks ago. So I think I speak on behalf of everybody to say it's great to hear you. We're glad you're recovering. And that is a very, very cheap way to at least attempt to get a trip in a helicopter. We know you're still hurting because of the Hornet and the Hunter thing from a few years ago. But listen, in all seriousness, that was pretty nasty and quite shocking. And it's very, very good to hear you that you're doing so well.
Thanks very much, guys. Really appreciate it. All right, you can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter, and if you want to see photographs of that, you can go back through my timeline. You can find me at all sorts of other places lurking around on the extended Facebook page. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from all of us here. Goodbye from Arthur Williams.
Yeah, see you guys.
Goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Bye all. See you next time.
Gareth Stringer.
Bye, folks.
And from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
This is XTP Media.